Welcome to the Jess Larson Show on Innovation and Leadership. Very excited to have my good friend Tom Bigley back on the show to co-host with me again. Many time guest and co-host. If you don't know Tom, he helps us out a lot at our charity Child Rescue. Has a background as an entrepreneur and a businessman, but probably best well known for being an Army Ranger in 2nd Battalion and then going on to a classified Army Special Mission Unit. And pretty excited for our guest, Tom Bigley. Why don't I let you introduce the other Tom this week?
It's my high school sweetheart, my buddy from high school. I known Tom when we went through high school. We were very good friends. And then, as he stated a little bit ago, but we did take different paths into the top of our fields, I think. So I'll let Tom describe himself, but I can say that he was one of my early mentors on how to do things right and work hard. So thanks, Tom. And I took that with me.
Thanks, Tom. You're way too kind to me. I mean, I think, I would start by saying that we were both good friends to each other. You took me on many of your adventures, some of which I assume that were beyond the statute of limitations we could probably talk about, but you have always been a guy that to me walked his own path. And thank you for getting two old friends, with an emphasis on old, as it appears from the video. But together, Tom and I, I would say really I would have counted Tom amongst my five or six best friends in high school. We spent many adventures skiing, out west as well. First time I ever was at Alta was with Tom. Almost died. Had a great time. Yep. Spent a day with a concussion and had to miss a day at Snowbird. I still remember that like it were yesterday. And also, spent many an afternoon racing up to various ski hills and on the Northeast and hustling home to get to my night job, and Tom hustling to get to his job, and missed school a few times when there was snow. And so we're great friends. And, we took very, very different paths in life. And we haven't seen each other in, since high school. So 43 years ago, I guess. It's great to reconnect with Tom, and it's great to have this platform, Jess, to talk about our careers and kind of our views on leadership and things of that nature. So thank you very much.
That's great. Well, why don't we give people a little bit of a taste of, being president at Ford in Australia and Brambles and all the different boards you're sitting on and just kind of some context for your career.
Sure. So look, we were talking this a little bit off air, but why are some people successful and others not? And I don't really know what the alchemy is here, but I do know one thing, that having two loving parents is a competitive advantage from the get-go. So I would have to say that I was blessed with two. I wouldn't call either of my parents overly sophisticated. They weren't really well-educated, but, they were loving parents that were incredibly supportive of me. And both of my parents had a great work ethic. And so, I got some of that in my DNA. I wanted to go to school. My parents wanted me to go on and pursue, college education. And Tom will remember this. I thought I could be a football player, actually. But I was anything but good, actually. But in my head, I was good. And I also had kind of an inflated view of myself, Jess. So we were probably too young to remember, but April 15th was a day that you used to get your acceptances or rejections to university in the mail. And on April 15th, I guess, of 1978, I got five rejections on the same day. And I had one of these moments where, well, you're actually not as good as you think you are. And Tom would remember, we had two teachers in high school. They were a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Green. I don't know if you remember them, Tom.
Yeah, I do.
Mr. Green taught math, and Mrs. Green was sort of an English teacher. Ironically, their daughter was a teacher at Sandy Hook. She survived, but was a teacher there. But it's interesting because Mr. Green took me aside my senior year, and he told me, "You are rapidly becoming an asshole." That's what he told me. And I remember that moment and the failures to sort of get where I wanted to go academically. And it kind of woke me up a little bit to maybe I'm not working hard enough. And so I wound up at Tufts University because I thought I could play football at Division III level, which proved to be a disaster. And I never saw the school. And also, you know, my parents didn't have much money, so I was on a scholarship there. And I, you know, the first day I showed up, the first day I saw the place was football practice. And the school changed my life. You know, it was, it was and continues to be a great academic institution. It was and continues to be a very diverse school, and a lot of international students. And it created a sense in me that there was a much bigger world. Although Tom and I went to high school in Trumbull, Connecticut, I was actually born and raised in Woodside, Queens. So I grew up in New York City. And it sort of, my aperture was quite narrow, right? I thought the world revolved around New York City. And when I got to Tufts, I saw all these different things and I really wanted to experience the world. And so I went and lived in Bolivia between my first and second year. I went and lived in France between my second and third year. And my parents allowed all this to happen. So I come back to them as kind of the real, you know, the real reason that I was able to do anything is they allowed me to do things. And even in high school, Tom will remember this, but I don't actually remember doing any work. I have no recollection of ever studying or anything. I found high school to be, you know, pretty easy. And Tom and I went to a small Catholic co-ed school and we all played sports together. You know, we had a lot of fun together. But I wouldn't say the school then put a premium on academics. And so I got a bit of a wake-up call at Tufts. And probably the other biggest thing is that I met the love of my life at Tufts. And because of her, really, my life kind of accelerated after university, I would say. And just to close the loop, went to become a commercial banker because everybody did. My wife didn't want to live in New York City. She was in law school. So I went to work for 3 years. And then when she got out of law school, I wanted to still continue to learn more. And I was fortunate enough to get into HBS. And so I graduated from there in 87. And I think sort of like Tom, in a way, a little bit, you know, countercultural in a way. Everyone from my class either went to Bain, McKinsey, or, you know, somewhere on Wall Street. And I had offers from all those places just because I wanted to prove to myself that I could. But I really wanted to work in American industry. And Jess, you probably don't remember this because you're too young, but in the 80s, you know, we were all going to become Japanese if we just wore a uniform and did exercises before work, somehow the quality of our products would get better. And I had a view that we were all giving up on American industry when we really shouldn't. So I went to work in Detroit. And I also wanted to live outside the United States and I wanted to have multiple experiences, but not change my employer every 3 years. So for 21 years, you know, I slugged it out at Ford, ultimately, you know, leaving the company from the position of president of Ford Australia. So, yeah, that's it. That's a lot of nonsense.
Well, let me correct you, Tom. I don't think you were an asshole in high school. So,
Green.
Well, I don't think Green was the smartest guy in the world anyway. But I do remember that, and I don't know. For me, the academics were not super challenging because I didn't really work that hard. But I wanted to better myself, so I ended up in, when I could do it, I ended up in a modern chemistry class with you. Yeah. And I think you sat either right behind me or right in front of me, one or the other, and drugged me through that course because it was at a much higher level of actual quality than I was used to in some of the mediocre classes that I was taking. So I appreciate that. But for me, I had to go, well, I had similar experience with parents. I had two great parents, very supportive of any direction I wanted to go and no money. And they made me go to Catholic high school. I had to pay for that though. So I'd work on the summer and I would pay the tuition and they made my sisters went to public school. My dad said, boys have to, you know, they can't get married to money. They got to go make their own. That was his point. And so he wanted something better for me. I did do a year and a half of college and then I just started a business because I just had to make money at that point. So with another fellow, you know, Paul Casey, we started a construction company and did very well. And then I just got disillusioned with some of the things, was kind of interested in going to the West Coast and like you maybe traveling some. and decided to join the Army to get to the West Coast. And then 28 years later, I retired from it. So to make a very long story, very brief, but through that time, I had the opportunity to work with every level of U.S. government and at the highest levels of the U.S. government. And that doesn't equate with competence just because they're higher levels, but some of them are. Some of them are extremely competent and brilliant people at the State Department, at the other alphabet agencies, we'll call them. And I had the opportunity to work with a lot of engineers and a lot of people because in special operations, we had the flexibility to add expertise if we thought we needed it. And they were very in tune to the operator level saying, hey, I need to know more about this and go find an expert. So we didn't try to reinvent the wheel. We would seek out expertise at any level. A quick example of that is we needed to know how to cut holes in, you know, it's 3 or 4 foot reinforced concrete to enter a building without using explosives. And, you know, sort of like, well, how are you going to do that? You're going to chip on it with a hammer, you know, what do you need to do? Well, you bring the mine or the dam people that built dams, and they cut big holes in concrete, and they do it rapidly, and we use their technology, and it works. So,
that's you know, time.
That was the kind of mentality. But my experience in leadership is based on experience directly, not, and I'm not to say that yours is not, but in the Army sense, you know, you kind of grow through these things. But I was very fortunate to have really good examples from the operator level or the staff level of people that were very, very good at what they were doing and some that weren't. And that's another example is if you see something that you don't like, don't emulate it. I mean, if you think somebody's treating you wrong, don't do that to the next person, you know, like, you know, people that are abused, you know, they start abusing their own kids, for example. So I always was told that. So I didn't think of a lot of these things myself. I was instructed that, and they said, you know, if you find something that you think works, use it, take it. If it works, maybe you can improve on it. Yeah. And I tried to do that, and I was very successful in the depth of training that I was able to do, and then turn that onto the civilian side as running the largest security company in Iraq, and then doing my own company that built a bunch of simulators in Africa for the Department of State and other things in consulting and so forth. So,
but you know, Tom, there's a common theme here in the things that you touched on. And I think it probably goes back to, you know, how we started, you know, our friendship and where we started from. And the common theme is humility to me. You know, a person that is not so full of themselves is willing to steal with pride is really what you've done, right? You learn from others rather than thinking that you know the answer. And that level of humility, I think, is fundamental to strong leadership. And, you know, as I said, I work with a lot of young CEOs. And the first question I ask them before I take them on as a client is, are you beyond where you ever thought you would be? And if they don't say yes to that question, I don't work with them. Because if you really think that your whole life you were meant to run this thing, you know, you have an inflated opinion of yourself in the same way that I described my opinion of myself when I was 18. So the first thing that I want to understand is that people want to grow and that they're surprised where they are. And the reason that they're surprised is because just like all of the things you've accomplished, and you could say some of the things that I've accomplished, I think that you've remained the same person more or less, and I've remained the same person. Like when you describe to me what you've done, you say it in a very casual way, like, you know, not that complicated. Anyone could have done it. You know, I went off and did it. And I kind of, when I listen to myself speak to you, it sounds very similar. So you have two people that are not too impressed, you know, kind of with who they are and who they became. And to me, that it starts with that sense of humility. When people walk in the room and they have to be the smartest person in the room, if you really have to be the smartest person in the room, you have zero chance of leading other people, because all you're going to do is surround yourself with people that are dumber than you are, right? And I work with some great CEOs now, Tom, that, you know, they have learned to build a team. And my mantra to people is, don't add someone to your team that doesn't make you better. And by you, I mean the enterprise you, right? So if this person isn't better than you at something, then why are they on your team? And it takes an awful amount of self-confidence, but the humility to admit that you don't know everything, you know? And I read that, you know, look, you and I've had a bunch of conversations in the last year or so. And I would say that that's one of your dominant traits and the reason that you've been so successful.
I agree with that. And I would just add to that, that the people that I've brought on as executives and or their background didn't really impress me. And, you know, I've hired generals and colonels and all these different people to work in pseudo military civilian positions. And I agree that if they don't bring something specific that I don't know or that I need help with. But the other thing is to make sure that they understand that they don't know everything. And if I tell them something, that I'm not telling them out of pride, I'm telling them because I know what I'm talking about. And I do know a lot of things, whether it's in management or leadership. And I want to make sure people are that I work with take me seriously too, in the sense of, if I tell you something, I'm not just talking.
Yeah.
And some people will relate to you in different ways. And I've always had to, in very high level things, I've had people tell me things. And then in retrospect, I was like, you know, I should have really listened closer to what that person was saying. And I was a little bit too full of myself at the time. So I try to train that out of people, even though they may be experts in a lot of different areas. It's not always that I need an accountant, for example.
Yeah. But, you know, Tom, I think what you're really talking about is how people progress with leadership, you know, how you start out and how you end up hopefully are not the same thing. And so, yeah, in the beginning, you know, if I think about early on in my career, well, I wouldn't say that I did this, but I've observed people that, you know, the gray-haired guy, let's avoid him because he doesn't know what he's doing. And he'll just tell you, look, we can't do it that way because we've done it this way for 100 years. You can imagine, you know, because of my resume, you know, people make certain assumptions about who I am because of my resume. So one of my jobs at Ford, I was a plant controller at the Dearborn Stamping Plant. So the Dearborn Stamping Plant is inside the Rouge Complex, which, if you know anything about manufacturing history, is a very famous place, you know, in Dearborn, Michigan. And immediately my nickname was Harvard, right? You know, just walk in the door and all the Harvard. And what I learned is that the old guys knew more than anything. You know, they'd spent their whole life there. And they were very, very willing to share. But in general, people didn't listen to them. And if you actually just sought them out, bought them a cup of coffee, you know, went and had a beer after work, they would unload on you so much knowledge that really helped the institution and helped the enterprise move forward. And so come back to this sense of humility. You know, if you're so arrogant to think, well, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to tell you how to run a plant, I'd never worked in a stamping plant. So how the hell could I tell anyone how to run it, right? And all these guys were dying to share their information with me. And they took such great pride in helping me. I think that they wanted to see me succeed. But they also took great pride in the fact that I listened to what we said. And then we implemented the suggestions that they made. Because, you know, in most cases, they were correct. And, you know, that I think that that's part of maturity, you know, through a leadership career. I don't think anybody starts out with the sense of perspective that you and I both have after, you know, 35 years in our various industries. You know, you gain that over time. But I know that from the beginning, I did, because of what my dad did, you know, I admired the toughness of my father. And so I didn't start out thinking I knew more than people. And I think that led to the fact that my career accelerated a bit faster than others, is that I was willing to work with anybody and I was willing to listen to people. And if you listen and execute what they're suggesting, you know, good things can happen.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Jess.
That's it. Well, I'm just thinking about the implementation of this, and I think it would be good, you know, everybody has opinions, and then some people have experience, right?
Yeah.
And I would love for people to get a little bit more of a scope of your experience. Can you talk about how big Ford Australia was when you were the president, and how big Brambles was when you were the CEO, and these kind of things?
Sure. Yeah. So Brambles is an enterprise that really most people never heard of. You know, it's an Aussie listed company. I guess when I was there, our market cap was $19 billion. So you'd call it a mid-cap, mid-size firm, a U.S. market. But we were fairly big in a small pond down there. You know, Aussie-listed companies, you got four big banks, gigantic miners, and sort of everybody else. And so we were kind of a big deal there. We operated in 64 countries around the world, 25,000 employees. And really, our business model was it was a rental model. We'd call it pooling. But we owned 500 million assets at the time that moved products. So think about pallets, foldable plastic containers that move fruits and vegetables, intermediate bulk containers that move, you know, industrial components around. We had an automotive business. So it was a very, very complex logistics company kind of hidden behind a very simple product. And the whole game was finding these assets, increasing the velocity, the movement of it, capturing the revenue from that, keeping them out of harm's way, collecting them quickly, so forth and so on. It was a big operation. It was head office was in Sydney, but the bulk of our business was not. Only 5% of our revenue was actually in Australia. So I spent, for 7.5 years, I spent most of my time on the road. Ford Australia was, at the time when I arrived in 2004, there were four manufacturers, believe it or not, in Australia. In 2016, there were zero. So the entire industry went away. Ford still has a really outstanding engineering center of excellence there. But when I was running the business, we had about 1,000 engineers. We did all of the engineering and design work for Asia Pacific. You know, we had a test track, we had a pilot plant, we had an assembly plant, an engine plant. It was a full automotive operation. Even though our volume was sort of less than one full plant's worth. And we had all the other functions, we had, finance, government affairs, industrial relations, all that stuff. I would say that it was a fantastic job. I'm sure someone from Ford may listen to this at one point in time, but we used to say that your level of happiness at Ford Motor Company was directly correlated to the distance you were from Dearborn or Detroit. And I think the only guy further away than me was the guy running South Africa. So I was the second happiest person at Ford.
You talk about advising young CEOs, and we've been lucky enough on the show to have quite a number of folks who've gotten their company over the $1 billion mark.
Yep.
And I guess maybe my question for you is, if you had advice for them as they're now looking at saying, hey, they'd like to get from 1 or 2 billion or 3 billion to that $19 billion kind of level. What's the difference between $1 billion company and a $19 billion company? Or what advice would you have for them?
Yeah, I mean, look, smaller companies are startups. I'm working with a guy who's running a startup today. I would tell you that size is sort of inversely correlated. A small startup is enormously complex. A 50-year-old company that has process and structure and capability in every area of the company is much easier to run. So this is my opinion. I've been in small places and I've run big places. I think there's four things that I try to tell my clients that I would say, irrespective of the size, this is what I think you need to do. None of these are going to surprise you, Jess. First is build your team. We talked on that already, but making sure that everybody that you put on the team is a careful selection and they're making you better. That's the first thing. The second thing, most CEOs, it's the first time they've ever had to manage a board of directors. So we spent a lot of time on managing your board. The Aussie model, the CEO is never the chairman. The US model differs by company, but most CEOs, all of a sudden they're wearing two hats. So managing that. The third, again, won't surprise you, but you have to deliver value. A really successful CEO told me once when I took over at Brambles, there are two types of CEO. The one that has been fired and the one that's going to be fired. So if you really want to avoid the latter, you better focus on delivering value. And look, I don't just mean shareholder value. I mean enterprise value. So value for the community, value for your employees, value for your shareholders. And the last is sometimes, I think, the most important, and maybe this is the only one that anyone will take away, but you must build safe harbors. You know, this statement that it's lonely at the top and, you know, employees say, look, you make enough money, buy a dog. The truth is that it's very difficult to know where you can go for advice. Within the organization, most people yes you to death. I used to write on my legal pad before every board meeting, these people are not my friends. Don't confuse the board with a mentor or a coach. They are there to represent the shareholders. So you must build, you know, a series of safe harbors. And what I mean by that is, you know, who's exciting the neurons? Who's challenging you intellectually? Who's challenging you morally? And where can you go to ask the dumb question? Because, you know, most chief executives don't want to show weakness to their own people, and they sure don't want to do that, you know, to their board. So I have really emphasized that with people I work with. And then I've tried to build out safe harbors for them. And a lot of times that's just connecting them to other CEOs, you know, and in unrelated businesses, because the leadership challenges are the same, you know, issues of culture, you know, issues of performance, issues around team building. Those are common, kind of irrespective of the business that you're in. So that's kind of my answer.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Tom Bigley, what kind of questions does that bring up for you?
Well, it's just actually a comment when he was going over that stuff. It was interesting to see how the correlation between what the special operations community does and when he said, you know, your team matters and, you know, you select the right people. Selection is a key part of Delta Force. They have to select. They go through a very rigorous process of selection, and not that many people are successful through that. And then once they get them there, they're still kind of, you know, just new meat sort of. And they do the same thing. Most of the guys like myself and people that show up there as a new guy, even though I had a reasonable amount of experience to get there, you have to look at the people that are there. There's some vast knowledge that you really have to get in tune with when you show up. And the gray-haired people, as you were talking about, Tom, are the older operators and so forth. So it's a very similar situation. Unfortunately, I don't think the Army does that at the Army level, they call it the big Army level. They don't do a very good job at that at all. And I think they're doing a much poorer job now. It's very challenging to just throw numbers at people and expect them to perform without some type of a selection process. It just doesn't work. And whether it's a corporate thing or not. And I had the same challenge in the corporate side with trying to hire staff or so. I tried to select the people that I thought could not only do the job, but could fit casually, I think, with the way I operated. You know, I'm trying to be very good here, but I'm kind of very hard on people sometimes with if they do something or say something that doesn't make any sense. I have no problem putting somebody on the spot, regardless of what level they are. And I was never, although a lot of people consider me their friend, I'm not necessarily their friend in the business sense. I mean, if I have a friendship with somebody outside of work, that's one thing. And I try to take care of my employees. And I think that's something else you're saying. You have to take care of the soldiers or the operators. And those things are key to success. You can't just gloss over some of the requirements of a certain position without trying to select somebody that fits those requirements. And I think that successful people do that much better and other people don't.
Yeah, I think, Tom, you know what you're saying. I mean, holding people accountable, you know, a lot of people want to be leaders, but they want to be everyone's friend. I mean, it's not different from parenting, right? You want to be your kid's friend, but you're not, you're their parent. And if you're going to run an organization, you have to hold people accountable. And I don't think you have to be disrespectful. You don't have to be vengeful. You know, you don't have to treat people poorly and hold them accountable. There was a guy who I would say was a friend of mine at Brambles, and, you know, he had run out of runway and there was no place for him to go. And I had to let him go. And, you know, it was hard for me to do that because I'd known him for a while. But I treated him with a great deal of respect. And I would tell you that probably for 2 years running, on our earnings release day, was the first email I got from anyone was from him to congratulate us on good performance. And you know, we left on good terms. He went on to be successful and he found where he really belonged. But if you don't hold people accountable, the organization knows this pretty quickly, right? When you keep a weaker member on your team, the organization knows that. And they either think that you're an idiot and can't see what I see, or you're too weak to lead us, because that one individual is somehow going to hurt the team in the long run. I mean, in your case, you know, failure has far more dire, you know, consequences than in my case. But I mean, I'm sure that in your case, Tom, you know, you can't really afford a weak link anywhere on the team, right? Or, you know, lives are at stake here.
I think there is a definitely a different component when you're working at, and I didn't really work at the Army level with the average guys. I did a little bit of that, but I always had the option to work in some kind of a special operations sense. So I don't, and I did work with the regular guys in Iraq somewhat, but the difference for me is that if I see something, there's not a bottom line with the Army. You know, we're not worried about making money. We're not worried about the quarterly outlook on what we turned for Q1 or two or whatever, right? They just throw money at stuff. And I'll give you just a sidebar story. I was trying to go to flight school I was trying to get the Army to pay for me to go to flight school because I told them it was a great idea. And my boss, this colonel, said, he goes, "We don't have any money for that. We're not sending." But he didn't know that I was actually good friends with the general that ran the whole place. I worked for him before that in a staff sense. So he showed up and I was chatting with him and I said, I said, "Hey, what's this deal? We don't have any money to send me to flight school." And he started laughing. He goes, "You guys get $25 million a year for your operations budget. You never even spend it all. And if you did, we'd give you twice as much." So I went back to my boss and said, "Bill Garrison said you're full of shit." And it was his exact words. And he's laughing. He goes, "Really? Why is that?" I go, "Because he said you got more than enough money to send me to school." He said, "You're not going to flight school."
But anyway,
was his coming back. But the point is that I think with the guys that I was dealing with, it does matter in the life. You know, there's a lot of, you know, I had people's lives in my hands many times, and people that worked for me died. I mean, in direct operations and civilian operations, all kinds of things. So it does matter to me that, and I wasn't trying to say that I was, and I probably am probably harsher than I should be sometimes, but I'm not demeaning anybody. I may just call them out on, "Hey, what you're saying is wrong, and here's why it's wrong, and here's why we're not doing it."
Yeah.
Because there's a risk factor or whatever the reasoning is. So I think it's definitely different in the Army sense, because you're absolutely leading people. And the answer was always, or the question was, you know, how do you lead people? It's basically you're getting people to do something that they naturally don't want to do.
Yeah.
And physically or, you know, effectively in their heart don't want to do something because it could be lethal. And that's a big difference between corporations.
But I think there obviously are differences in degrees of severity here, right? You know, the severity of the outcomes in a military context are quite different than the outcomes in a corporate context. But at the root of it, we're all trying to do the same thing, right? So what you're trying to do in a corporate leadership is you're trying to get people to buy into a vision and a direction. And you're also trying to get people that have a job, right? Not a career, but a job. So in your parlance, I'd say big Army guys just show up. It's a job. I can either make French fries or I can go in the Army, right? So, you know, that's not a career. You had a career and I had a career. It's a job. So how do you give people that just have a job a sense of ownership, a sense of commitment, and a sense of belonging, right? When I was at Brambles, we worked with a guy and we really worked on this. We worked on this idea of getting the organization to behave as one. And the three things that we focused on is, what do you believe? How do you behave? And to which group do you think you belong? And if you can get people, if you can understand what people believe, and if you can really get at the heart of how they behave, you can eventually figure out how to get them to belong. And that's really what you're trying to do. The Army does it in a very, 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 my observation, the military does it in a very specific way. You take people away, you put them on a campus, you know, you keep them together. You know, there's a sense of, there's a fraternal organization there. That's not how the corporate world works. You come into work for 10 or 12 hours a day, and then you go home. You know, you typically work Monday through Friday, you travel a fair bit, so forth and so on. But the way that in the corporate world, you're trying to get people to belong is different than the way you do. We have very different tools, but we're both trying to get the same thing, right? And I think, you know, Jess, you would see this, I'm sure. You know, when I started my career, the answer was, you have a job, you should be thankful for that, shut up and move on. But now people are mission driven. People want to know, what is the purpose of this organization? What are we actually trying to accomplish? And I'm sure, Tom, you saw this. A lot of people join the military because they believe in American exceptionalism. They believe that we're right, right? And they have a certain amount of patriotism. They have a certain amount of, you know, a desire to defend their nation. Those people are very, very easy to motivate. It's the kid who shows up because he doesn't have many other alternatives that's much harder to motivate.
Well, that was the problem with the draft. And, you know, you have draftees come in and they're forced labor. And the same thing if you're working in, you know, at certain, I'm sure at corporate levels where you just got the hourly workers coming in to punch plates at a stamping plant. And I worked at some factories. I worked at U.S. Surgical in Norwalk, Connecticut. And when I started, there was a summer job, you know, we were making surgical staplers. And I was greasing these stupid things all day long on an assembly line. What was interesting is they pulled me out of there. They said, hey, you're actually good at that, which is shocking because nobody is. And we're going to put you in quality control. And I started doing some different things. But I think you're right. I think the leadership model, a guy that worked for me used to always say, you have to ride the brand. So whatever, like if you're working for X company, you have to be all in on this brand. So if you don't work for them, that's fine. But if you're going to be here and you work for Ford, Ford's it. That's what I'm going to.
You know, in my career, you know, John Devine, who was one of my mentors, was the CFO, and he sort of lost out in the race to be CEO, and he went to General Motors, and he called me, and there was just no way I could leave. I mean, you know, I could never do that. I mean, I was on Team Blue, and I wasn't going to leave that team. And I didn't, and when I left, I never, you know, I wasn't in the automotive industry anymore. So I wasn't competing. It'd be like if you and I, you know, in our junior year in high school decided to go to Fairfield Prep, that would never happen. Right? This day I hate those guys, right? So I think, yeah, I mean, I think I was all in on Ford. I mean, I really only worked at two big places and, you know, I was all in on both of them. So, yeah. So I don't know, Jess, we're wandering about here. Do you want to get us back on track here?
I don't think you're wondering. I actually want to double down on where you've been going. And again, back to these, you know, these leaders that I get to spend time with, kind of what, you know, whether in the several hundred millions or crossed over the billion mark. And privately, like after the recording ends, they want to know about like the other guests that I had, you know, Eric Wongru, Zoom to 20 billion, Fred McColl, I've got Cathera to 22 billion. You know, I had last week, I had Jeff Hoffman, who, you know, founder of it, Priceline, you know, they got to the 100 billion, right? And the billion-dollar guys want to know, well, what did those guys say? You know, like, and they're confident, they've got so much to share, and I'm so happy to learn from them. But then as soon as it's off, they want to know what the other guy said, you know? and it's actually a really fun thing for me, because even though I have not achieved their levels yet, I at least get to be a conduit, and hopefully I'm building my own knowledge base as I try to build my companies, right? And something that I kind of want to double down as we're talking about people is this idea of people at scale. You know, you're really a $19 billion organization, 25,000 staff. And yeah, what about these people where it's just a job? I would love any practical tips for these These billion-dollar CEOs whose staff may have 10 times or 100 times in the last short number of years, and they're quite frankly, like, floundering a little bit on, like, leading this type of scale.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm working with a guy now who's going through that process, you know, and I think what happens is when you start out and, you know, you see there's any company that starts up, you know, everybody, you know, I know everybody in the building. We go from 25 to 50 to 100. I still walk around the building and I recognize people. And then one day they'll say, I don't even know who anybody is, right? And the problem is that they're still managing it as if it's a 50-person or 100-person enterprise. And, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs think that the idea of structure and cadence is like somehow a germ that we should avoid. But nobody is successful without some amount of structure and cadence. So when you're growing, you have to prepare for that by anticipating the structure that we're going to need, right? And I think a lot of people are deathly afraid of fixed cost, and we don't want to add people ahead of this, but sometimes you need to put that structure in place. And so I spend a lot of time with younger guys really talking about organizational design and organizational dynamics. So yes, I didn't pick every one of the 25,000 people, but I surely picked the 7 direct reports to me. And then they knew what we were looking for from a culture perspective. You know, our mantra at Brambles was blue collar with brains. That was our mantra. And, you know, you can define it in many different ways, but the way we defined it is we're going to work hard, we're going to know the business, we're going to get our hands dirty, and we're slightly smarter than the competition. That's what we meant by that. So if you didn't buy into that, then, you know, you surely weren't going to work for me. And the people that worked for me, you know, they emulated that behavior. So you can still control, you can still drive the culture of the organization, but you have to do it with the mindset that you're now driving it through other people, not just yourself. And, you know, you've mentioned a lot of people that are sort of superheroes. So there's a bit of cult of personality. That's not that common. Most people are kind of invisible. You know, you're a big deal in your own company, but if you want to build a culture, you really have to build it through the people that work for you. And don't be afraid of putting, you got to have some structure. I'm sure you see this with people that, you know, their businesses just flame out because they were just poorly organized. They didn't anticipate things. We didn't invest in the proper systems. We don't have the proper HR capability. We can't add people fast enough, and the people we're adding are terrible. And so, I mean, that sounds, you know, counterintuitive, but you do need cadence and culture. And, you know, I think that Tom will comment on this for sure, but I've always thought that leadership was really three things, and I tell this to people all the time, but it's aggravate, educate, and motivate. Those are the three things that you're supposed to do. And I don't mean aggravate, just wake up in the morning and piss people off, but you're meant to ask the question that they don't want to be asked. And I think Tom alluded that to earlier. If somebody's doing something wrong, guess what? You have to call them out on it. That's the leadership role. And if you're not comfortable doing that, if you're not comfortable calling a spade, you will not be successful. The second thing is that you have to motivate people. You actually have to get them. This is the point that Tom made. You have to get them to align on a direction that, you know, in your case, Tom, they're probably biologically opposed to going, right? Nobody wants to throw themselves into a firefight, I'm sure, right? But somehow you are motivating enough to get people to follow your direction. And the third thing, which I think a lot of people forget, is this issue of educating. The senior executive has the widest aperture, and he or she has to share that with people below them. So don't just say, do this because I said to do it. You know, do it because it fits here. And your role is important because your contribution gets us to there. And I think that must be the same in the military. I can't imagine it being different.
You know, I think it is. Go ahead. In the Army, they kind of have, at all levels of the Army, whether it's special operations or the regular Army, that you can only effectively lead 4 people. Now, that you can stretch that a little bit, because if you end up being a commander, you have 4 commanders that you might be leading, but you also have a staff with some key people. So when Tom said 7 or 8 guys, that's probably about the limit that you should be able to deal with directly and educate them and select them, for, you know, in his case, that's who you want to select. That'd be, I would say the same thing. It's not always the case with the Army. Sometimes they just give you people, but you have the, usually have the option. And when I, where I worked, if somebody was at first glance, if I didn't like them, I'd change them. So, I mean, it'd be very quick. But the other thing in leadership is how he stated that motivating people is very important, along with educating them and all that. But to motivate somebody is a key thing that I think very successful leaders at any level, whether it's corporately or Army or Navy or wherever, that the people that come to the top of the pile have the ability to motivate people. And it's just irreplaceable. I don't think it's those three things. I don't think you can skimp on them. There's other things that you might be able to play with, but those leadership traits are critical in my experience in everything.
Yeah.
Corporately or whatever.
Yeah. We were talking, you know, earlier about, you know, people want to be part of an organization that has purpose and be mission driven. And I've seen that evolve over the last 30 years. But I also believe that one constant that I've seen since the beginning of my career is even though you're part of a larger organization, people actually work for people. They don't actually work for enterprises. They work for people. So, you know, I always felt that the people that worked for me really worked for me personally. And the people that I worked for, I had to connect with them in a way. I wanted to be part of their team and see them being successful. And, it, you know, really, at the end of the day, one of the reasons I left Ford is that I started losing that. I didn't look up and see the people that I really wanted to work for anymore, you know. And I think that happens to a lot of people. You get to a certain level as the pyramid narrows and you look up and, you know, maybe it isn't as impressive as you might have thought when you were two or three rungs below. But we do work for people still. And, you know, if you were, I'm sure you were a great leader, Tom, because people connected with you. You know, not only did they trust that you were going to keep them safe, right, and complete the mission successfully, but they wanted to see you succeed. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that from a leadership perspective. I mean, if you can get people to connect with you, you know, again, how people motivate people very differently, but nevertheless, you must have that as part of your leadership toolbox, along with the ability to educate and the ability to aggravate or challenge. Aggravate's probably not the best word, but to challenge people to do better.
I like aggravating people, so that's okay. this was a great opportunity, Jess. I think you're about...
Thank you very much, Jeff.
I think you're about over with the timeline. Hopefully I get to chat with you offline here, Tom, at some point. Let me know. Where do you want to go here, Jess? You want to... For me, you're at the 3 o'clock hour. So
yeah. Tom Berman, if people want to connect with you online, is LinkedIn the best place, or what would you say to people?
Yeah, that's the best, because if they can come to me through LinkedIn, and then it, you know, comes in my email box, and I'll respond if people want to have a chat. No problem.
Yeah,
I don't want to talk to anybody. So if you want to connect with me, talk to Jess.
It actually is true. Most people call me.
And they're like, that's a fact.
I should call.
No.
Tom Berman, maybe to finish off here, what's one of the best pieces of advice you ever received?
You know, I would say that I'm going to answer that in two ways. The best piece of advice that someone actually told me was to define your job broadly. That was the best piece of advice. And what they really were trying to tell me is don't be closed to opportunities because you've defined yourself so narrowly. So, and this really happened at Ford. I got this advice because when I first got there, straight out of HBS, not a lot of HBS cats went there. And I was given some really unique opportunities to build my skill set early on. And I never said no. You know, I moved to Paris. I went to a stamping plant. Whenever they said to do something, if I felt like I was learning and developing and expanding my skill set, I did it. So that's, but the best life lesson that I've learned, and Tom would remember this guy, I played football in high school, and we had a coach who I worshipped at the time. He's still alive, by the way, Ed McCarthy.
Oh, okay.
He wouldn't like, but we used to call him Spanky. He looked like Spanky from the Art Gang comedy. We never called him that to his face. But the thing that he taught me was that enthusiasm and hard work can overcome a lack of capability. And we had a very, very successful football team, and we really had no superstars. But he created a sense and a belief in ourselves that we were actually a lot better than we were. And I would say that everybody on that team was committed to the person next to them. It was a group of guys that really loved each other in a football team way. And I have, I mean, I'm sure, Tom, I'm an enthusiast. I wake up pretty ready to go. I wake up to be enthusiastic. My life, I have been blessed far more than I ever deserved. And that enthusiasm, willingness to put in the hard work, willingness to do things, I think has led, you know, has covered for, you know, shortcomings in other areas. And I would encourage people, nobody wants to work for a sad sack, right? People want to work for people that believe that we can, you know, we can accomplish the task at hand. So advice and the best observation on it.
I love it. Well, thank you for making time to do it.
All the best, guys. Tom, we'll catch up next week.
Hey, no problem, Tom, whenever. Whatever works for you. Text me or something.